St. Thomas Aquinas, in his Summa Theologiae, asks the question whether a beatified angel can sin. The word beatified there just means made blessed. So an angel who has chosen for God and so enjoys the vision of God forever in heaven. He responds in this way. It belongs to the perfection of its liberty for the free will to be able to choose between opposite things, keeping the order of the end in view. But it comes of the defect of liberty for it to choose anything by turning away from the order of the end. And this is to sin. Hence, there is greater liberty of will in the angels who cannot sin than there is in ourselves. I'm going to read that again. It belongs to the perfection of its liberty for the free will to be able to choose between opposite things, keeping the order of the end in view. But it comes of the defect of liberty for it to choose anything by turning away from the order of the end, and this is to sin. Hence, there is greater liberty of will in the angels who cannot sin than there is in ourselves. The insight here is provocative. It goes against our intuitions and will prove for us a kind of occasion of further inquiry. Namely this, okay. Greatest freedom is to be found in heaven when we are bound to the end and beyond the possibility of defection. Greatest liberty is to be found in heaven where we cannot but choose God. We cannot look away because it's a vision that is wholly satisfying, that admits of no lessening and no fear of loss. And in that vision, we are most perfectly free. This, I think, is contrary to the prevailing notion of what constitutes freedom or liberty. Our modern notion, also, is rooted in our modern understanding of nature and human nature. So what we're going to do for this talk is very simple. We're going to examine the prevailing notion, the modern notion, as to what constitutes freedom, and then we're going to examine the understanding of nature which undergirds that thought, and then I'm going to propose an alternate notion, an alternate theory as to what our human nature is, and then show how we can build that out to an alternate theory of freedom. So we're going to start with modern, freedom, and then nature, and then move to ancient and medieval, nature, and then freedom. So you see how it goes. So first, the modern notion of freedom. We can think about this first in terms of our present historical setting. The political dispensation in which we experience life is one of political liberalism. So this isn't to say like liberal versus conservative. This is just to say the whole atmosphere in which we operate. The kind of notion that my rights end where your rights begin. That many things about public life and discourse are premised on consent. Right, that thing is good to which I consent, to which both parties consent, and that is bad in the instance that consent is withheld, and that we're principally concerned with not doing harm. So there's really no substantive vision of what the good is. You know, that's not really proposed for us. But rather, political liberalism attempts to remain outside of considerations of what constitutes the good so that each individual who shares in this life can pursue his own notion of what the good is. Now, the backdrop to this is a kind of political prehistory, one of that's really written into a history of Enlightenment philosophy, which need not detain us at this juncture, but we can say simply that it has metaphysical dimensions, okay, so we're talking about being, it has ethical dimensions, so we're talking about how one acts, and then it has political dimensions, namely how we conduct ourselves in civil society. And we can isolate certain notions that are associated with this understanding of freedom. The first I would submit, and I think we all recognize this, is just one of non-coercion. So we have it in our minds that freedom is opposed to violence of any sort. So if I am being forced, then I am not free. So we can go beyond this, though, to a more embracing theory where people will contend that my choice ought not be or should not be conditioned in any way. So I should be able to choose irrespective of the input of culture or tradition of instruction or counsel, of thought and emotion. So I am free to the extent and degree that I can just choose, come what may, and regardless of input. So that's just one theme, one of non-coercion. On the other hand, there is a strong notes here of sovereign self-rule or autonomy. Many people living in the present day and age associate freedom with being able to rule oneself. So autonomy, you've heard this word, autonomy, it comes from the Greek word meaning law and oneself. So to be a law unto oneself is often counterposed to heteronomy, right? The law of another, which would then be imposed on us. So there's this great insistence upon autonomy to the extent that it can be realized. So in our contemporary discourse, we rejoice very much in having a space for self-expression and being able to express ourselves to the degree that it is possible. Okay, so I'm going to quote here just a small passage from a Supreme Court decision, Planned Parenthood versus Casey, in which this notion is given very peculiar, distilled expression. The judge says, "At the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life. Beliefs about these matters could not define the attributes of personhood were they formed under compulsion of the state." I'll read it again. Again, what we're trying to access here is this notion that man is utterly undetermined and free to self-determine, to be a law unto himself. It reads, "At the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life. Beliefs about these matters could not define the attributes of personhood were they formed under compulsion of the state." Now, from these factors, we have emerge a notion of freedom which we'll call freedom of indifference. Freedom of indifference. In this understanding, the will is just constitutive of human identity. So I am a chooser. I am a chooser. And I am to the extent and degree that I choose. Also in this notion, the will is often construed or conceived as getting out ahead of the intellect. So it's not so much a matter of what one thinks as it is a matter of what one chooses. The will is the arbiter between liberty and obligation, and you realize yourself as you choose. In this understanding, our freedom or our free will, our free choice, is principally seen as a power to opt for this or for that, for yes or for no, for right or for wrong, etc. And it consists in a kind of indetermination or indifference with regard to these contraries, and thus a power of radical self-determination. If at this point you're thinking, this is like somewhat corresponds with my experience, I can kind of supply examples that bolster this point, but it seems a little bit overly philosophical and jargony, fear not, okay? This is the most involved of the thing. We're just setting this up to really get out, to get underneath to a notion of nature, so that way we can understand what is being said about the human person in this vision. Why is there such an insistence placed on non-coercion and on self-rule or autonomy? So let's move now to then the modern notion of nature. We can track this through the history of science and through the history of philosophy, that nature has kind of been trivialized in our discussion as to who man is and what he is for. So in the modern approach to nature, there is a setting aside of things that before were very much prized and seen as, kind of like constitutive of our consideration of man. So a classic way to approach the question would be to ask, why? Why is this thing, namely humans, why is it this way and not another? And in one particular philosophical tradition, we would answer this question by asking what causes it to be the way it is. And the typical way in which you would answer this question was to isolate the stuff that it's made from, what gives it shape or makes it to be what it is, who makes it to be thus and such, and then what is it for? Classically, this is called the four causes, right? So you have the stuff from which it's made, the material cause or the matter. You have the shape, the structure, the kind of intelligible unity of the thing, or its form or formal cause. You have the person who makes it to be such, which we call the efficient cause or agent cause, and then the purpose for which, which is called the final cause. Now, in the history of philosophy, it became common to set aside formal causes and final causes. So we weren't so much concerned about what makes a thing to be what it is, nor were we so much concerned with discerning why it was ever made in the first place or how it ever came to be. Instead, we're just talking about stuff and force. We're talking about the stuffness of it and then the forceness of it. And that effectively exhausts our consideration of the matter at hand. And this is typically the approach of the modern sciences. So, when you go about then examining the human person with these philosophical tools, you can begin to appreciate how your scope would be limited, and you're only going to come up with answers that fall within that scope, and you're going to dismiss as magical or otherwise trivial the things that fall without that scope. So if you're only searching for a particular answer, you're going to dismiss as nonsensical or as silly or naive those that fall without your considerations. So you can see how this would affect our study of human nature. We might ask the question, just kind of commonsensically, what is it that men have in common, or what is it that constitutes a good life for man? But with this modern philosophical or modern scientific approach, it's easy to rule out the notion of a common nature, to rule out the notion that there is something that makes us all to be what we are and to have that nature in common, because each of us is just kind of atomized parcels of matter, exercising force or having force exercised upon us. So what is it that makes you like you? Well, that you're all made out of the same stuff. So it becomes kind of reductionistic. And no longer are we asking, like, what is in the heart of man? Or, Lord, what is man that thou hast kept him in mind? So with this dismissing of nature, we also have a dismissing of normative claims. Okay? So it becomes difficult to say what a human person ought to do if we have no sense of what a human person is. Because, like, for instance, you can think of Ariel, right, in The Little Mermaid. Okay, great classic, early 90s, wonderful time. Maybe it was late 80s, hard to say. It was kind of in the golden age of puffy case VHSs. But Ariel doesn't know what things are for, right? She's got whosits and whatsits aplenty, all right? And so she interacts with these objects in very bizarre ways, like using forks to comb her hair, which causes us revulsion, right? Unless it's animated beautifully, and then we're like, yeah, that's great. So if you don't know what a thing is, it's very difficult to interact with it according to how one ought to interact with it. And if you dismiss this question of what man is, then how can we begin to entertain questions of what man is for and how best to live? So what we get in the end is you be you, okay? Live your best life. You are all unique and individual snowflakes, which is true as far as it goes, but it just doesn't give you much in the way of rules for living, okay? We need to look to Jordan Peterson for that. So here, in this understanding, meaning and the good life is not something to be discovered, clarified, and progressively lived according to a normative standard. Rather, it's something to be constructed. It's something to be invented. And if so, then freedom is just the space in which this project unfolds. So you are literally free to be whatever you want, even if in so being you sow the seeds of your own destruction. It's very fascinating. You know, you are literally free to ruin your life in the modern understanding. And who could tell you otherwise? Okay. So that's our modern section. We had a modern notion of freedom, and we see how that modern notion of freedom is rooted in a modern notion of nature. Now we're going to build up an alternate proposal. And I'm not going to argue for it too terribly much. Rather than being like apologetic, I'm going to be more catechetical. So if you think that, hey, you didn't substantiate that point, you're going fast and loose, like, who are you? You can ask those questions at the end of the talk. So first, we'll do a classical medieval notion of nature, and then we'll do a classical medieval notion of freedom. So in Aristotle and St. Thomas's understanding of nature, nature is a principle of motion and of rest. At first, that may seem uninspired and not especially compelling. But let's unpack it. So when we're talking about a nature is the essence of a thing, okay? Its formal identity, its very substance. We're asking what the thing is and what makes it to be what it is. We're building up a picture here that goes beyond force and stuff, that takes into account, in the case of human persons, for instance, the soul, which makes a man to be alive, and to be alive is this type of creature. So nature is both form, and it's also finality. So it gives indication as to what we are, but also what we are for. So first, form. Nature accounts for our specific identity. Remember, we talked about the four causes: material cause, formal cause, efficient cause, and final cause. We're talking about a formal cause. We're talking about what makes a thing to be what it is. It's a principle of integrity, a principle of coherence, a principle of interiority, and a principle of agency, which is to say, it holds the thing together. It accounts for the fact that we can access what this thing is. It also accounts for the fact that this thing has functions or powers that go beyond the merely superficial. And it accounts for the fact that this thing can act in the world in a way that's proper to it. So nature, in this sense, also accounts for the fact that we can be, or things can be, members of a kind, so that there is a human nature to be described, and then we can compare ourselves or others to human nature. There are better and worse instances of a nature. So like, for instance, I went to Franciscan University of Steubenville, and there is a deer there with only three legs, affectionately named Tripod. Okay? So when you saw the deer on campus, you would say, that is a deer. And then if somebody asked you, how many legs does a deer have, you would say four. And then the person could point out, but like, Tripod has three legs. And then you would say, but deers are supposed to have four legs. And you could recognize the fact that Tripod was deficient in that respect. Which doesn't mean to say that, like, Tripod is bad and evil and ought to be shunned from our company, right? But it doesn't mean that because there is an aberrant instance of a deer, that we then go back to the drawing board and reconceive what it means to be a deer. Formerly, it was a four-legged creature, you know, which is kin with Bambi. But now it's a four- or three-legged creature because we found one instance. No, that's not what we're doing when we talk about a nature. We're talking about what obtains always and for the most part. And it's also a standard whereby we can recognize what is a departure, what is a less excellent or less perfect instantiation of the kind, okay? So we have in our sense what a human person should be, okay, like paragons of humanity, and we can compare ourselves to them and realize our nature more or less excellently, okay? So it's a temptation to compare ourselves to people who are excellent humans in one respect or another, but we only really derive comfort, consolation, and direction from comparing ourselves to the one who lived humanity perfectly, okay? This is why you often hear in like spiritual discussions that you can only compare yourself to Christ. Right? Because in comparing yourself to those around you, you often either contemn them or contemn yourself. G.K. Chesterton wrote that comparison, not familiarity, comparison breeds contempt. So nature is this specific identity. It accounts for the fact that a thing is what it is. And we've already kind of gotten ahead of ourselves here, but nature is also finality. So it gives us the standard and the goal of progressive realization. So we are on the way towards the fullness of who we are meant to be. And nature sets before us that trajectory. So when we talk about finality or final cause, we're talking about that for the sake of which. We are talking about that for the sake of which. So we talked about Ariel and her who's its and what's its. Those are functional things, and they are more perfect when they are exercised according to their intended function. All right? And if we use them outside of their intended function, then they can cause great damage. Right? So you know, like when you have the right tool for a thing, it's very easy to carry out the task. But when you go about it with the wrong tool, then you can do great damage to the thing that you're working with. So I was asked on Saturday to remove a zip tie from an air pump so as to release like one of those needles that you use to pump up a ball. Okay, and I didn't have a pair of scissors. If I'd had a pair of scissors, this would have taken me like 2 seconds. Instead, I had a key, okay? And so I used the key as like a makeshift saw, but I did damage to the pump itself, which is, you know, counter to my purposes. So you can understand that when we use a thing according as it is intended to be used, it flourishes, and we flourish in our relationship with it. But when we use it contrary to its purposes or outside of its range of intended purposes, then we can actually do damage. We are a thing like this. We are intended for a certain end. And if we try to act as if we were not, then we can do great damage to others and to ourselves. So the trajectory of our lives is actually set by what we are. Nature is a principle of rest and of motion. It's a principle of identity and of unfolding. So then, we flourish to the extent that we interact profitably with the goods that are intended for us. So St. Thomas will observe, we are a substance, and like all substance, we want to continue in existence, right? So we eat, and we drink, and we are merry. He also observes, we are animals, and so we should do those things and pursue those goods which are proper to animals. One of the goods proper to animals, the principal good proper to animals, is procreation and education of children. You are not a good fox unless you hand on fox life, unless the adjective is foxy life, but then it becomes confusing, right? So there are goods on offer, and we need to interact with those goods. We need to engage those goods in a profitable way. But he observes further that not are we mere animals, we are rational animals. And so there are certain goods to which we are addressed as human beings, with which we need to engage profitably. He lists, to know the truth about God, to live well in society, to shun ignorance, and to avoid offending those with whom we live. This is not meant as an exhaustive list, but this is to say that we are addressed to certain spiritual goods. And that is set for us, the terms of that is set for us by virtue of what we are. So, there are certain goods for us as human beings, as rational animals, and to the extent that we engage with them profitably, we are built up. We acquire certain perfections that arise in light of what we are. Now, as human beings, we act to attain these goods through the powers of our soul. So, we are a composite of body and soul. That's not to say that we're two things, body and soul kind of strangely joined together, but we're one thing, an embodied soul or an ensouled body, depending on how you want to describe it. Okay? And we act through our soul. So the body is for sake of the soul, and the soul is the locus, the place of our powers, which are basically the way by which we engage with our environment. This may sound abstract, but these powers are kind of natural for us or connatural for us to recognize. So we have powers of growth, of self-nourishing, of reproduction. We have powers of sensation, right? Both exterior senses and interior senses. We have powers of sense appetite, right? Desires that come with our sensations. And we can observe at the height of our powers, we have minds with which to know, and we have hearts with which to love. So we have powers whereby to engage with the goods on offer that are addressed to us for the upbuilding of our life. And from those powers issue acts. Those acts are ordered to the objects of our powers. And those powers can be better or worse. You know, they can be exercised more or less excellently. And this is the whole purpose of the life of virtue. That virtue is a stable disposition, a stable or permanent disposition of the mind and heart, which enables us to choose our good easily, promptly, and joyfully. That is to say, we don't have to constantly struggle or anguish over what we're made for because we have these dispositions of the heart, these habits, which make it easy for us to recognize what is good and to pursue it. So again, keep this in mind. The saint is not the moral juggernaut who wakes up every morning and says, like, ah, I don't want to do the things, but I will do the things. Rather, the saint is the one who wakes up and says, like, let's go. You know, I was made for this, and I love it. You know, like, exactly. Right? So, that is what the saint says and does. So, one aspect of our powers, one aspect of our lives, our human lives, is that we have appetites. So there's kind of two dimensions in how we engage with reality. We cognize it, okay, so either we think about it intellectually or kind of by way of our senses, and then we desire it. And that desiring piece is just what we mean by appetite. So there are appetites which are just immediately attendant upon nature. So there's things that we incline just by the mere fact that we are. So we just gravitate towards certain goods. We don't have to think about it. We don't have to discern. We just go in that direction. Okay, so this is like when you think about animals, like instinct. A sheep does not need to be taught that a wolf will kill it. It just sees the wolf and then it flees. So there are certain things like that where we just immediately and intuitively incline towards what we're made for. There are other appetites, though, that come with sensation. So you're like strolling down whatever street. Okay, I should know the streets here. You're strolling down Highland, and then you hear the dulcet tones of music like wafting out of Highland Coffee. And then it conjures in your mind an image of the last, like, dark roast coffee that you had there. And while you have already had 3 cups today, the thought of, like, comfort and warmth and the communion of those who are seated at those very delightful tables, it just overwhelms you. And so then you find yourself kind of tripping along towards Highland Coffee, paying for something for which you have not the money, indulging in something for which you have not the appetite, etc. Okay, so this is what we mean by, like, sense appetite. Something appeals to us in a sensory way, and then we incline to it by virtue of, you know, our sense appetite. But then we have a rational appetite. So here, we're thinking about things in a kind of immaterial way. So let's say that I am engrossed in a conversation as to what it means to be good, okay? And it's like a very intense conversation with somebody who's very wise and has challenged me to, like, be a better person. And I realize that I've been a slug-a-bed, a sluggard, two words that are often used in colloquial English. And I am rebuked interiorly at my laziness, and I have a kind of conversion of heart, and I resolve to set my alarm 15 minutes earlier. So this is something that, like, animals don't do, right? Animals don't have regrets. Animals don't resolve on ongoing conversion. Animals don't, like, agonize as to whether or not to push the snooze button. Okay, this is something that is proper to us by virtue of the fact that we have minds whereby we can think about things immaterially, conceptually. So this appetite, this intellectual appetite, this rational appetite is just what we mean by the will. Okay? We've been coming to this point. This is the climax. This is like where we've come to. That's all we mean by the will. So the will isn't something over here independent of considerations of the good. It's a way that we as human beings are addressed to particular goods that are for us as rational animals. So the will, or intellectual or rational appetite, is one of the highest powers of the human person, and it's just the appetite for the intellectually apprehended good. It's a power that originates from within the agent. It has this note of interiority. And also, kind of tangentially, side note, this is part of what it means to be made to the image and likeness of God. So it's said in the scriptures, in Genesis 1, 26 maybe, that in the image of God he made them, to the image and likeness he made them. And in that, the Christian tradition often reads an association with intellect and will, that we have powers that mirror God's interior life more perfectly than does lower creation. So we have these faculties, these powers, these capacities of knowing and loving which make us like God. And what is more, we can, with these powers, know and love God. And then at its height, we can know God with his own knowledge and love God with his own love, so that the interior dynamic of the very Holy Trinity becomes the interior dynamic of the human mind and heart. It's pretty wild, actually. Okay, so that's all we mean to say by nature. That's all we mean to say by nature. And for our fourth and final point, a classical or medieval notion of freedom. And it's for this that we have come. So lower appetites, what we described when we talked about, like, growth and nutrition and reproduction, these are determined. These are determined. As we encounter them, for instance, in, like, minerals, like rocks, or in plants, or in animals, we only ever encounter them in determined fashion. So a rock can't but be rocky. A plant can't be but planty. And an animal can't be but animally. Right. But we are not so much determined as we are underdetermined in our nature. And there are two sources of our being undetermined. We're going to unpack this. So first, we're going to call freedom of exercise, and then second, we're going to call freedom of specification. You don't need to memorize these. If you have writing materials, you could write them down. So freedom of exercise. We have a kind of freedom or undetermination with whether or not we act. So we can choose whether or not to act. St. Thomas draws an analogy with sight. He says, when you have your eyes open, you can't but see. You cannot but see. Which is why it's torturous when someone holds your eyes open, not only because your eyes dry out, because sometimes you are forced to see things that you would otherwise prefer not to see. But when you have your eyes open, you cannot but see. But, he notes, you can close your eyes. So you're like, I can't help myself, I'm just seeing the things. It's like, no, you could close your eyes. So if there's, like, a movie and it has like dubious content, you're like, oh, yikes, dubious content. What a bummer. I can't but see, you know. You can close your eyes, right? Or if you have a scapular, you can cover the whole television and close everyone's eyes. Okay. So we have freedom of exercise. Furthermore, we have freedom of specification. Because whenever we look at a thing, we are never bound to choose it in the strict sense, because we can see it as good or evil in different ways. So for instance, think about those goods which are most irresistible, most delicious, most undeniably good. So like crawfish po' boys, for instance, right? It's a Friday in Lent. You happen to be driving through Lafayette. You see Old Time Grocery. You're attracted as if by gravitation. And like, it's almost as if you haven't chosen any of these sequences of events. Like your car drove itself. You are literally in the first driverless car. Like they gave you the Google car for the purpose. And you arrive there and you're in line. And this seems to be the best possible thing. It has overwhelmed you. You are undone in its presence. Okay? This seems like the type of thing that you cannot but choose. It is good in every aspect. There is no way in which it is evil. But say, for instance, that someone toddles in behind you. Okay? And you hear them saying, I have come for this alone. I'm 89 years old. My body is riddled with cancer. I was raised in a small town in Lower Germany. And since the moment of my being weaned from my mother's breast, I have heard tell of the crawfish po' boy. And I have come here now to enjoy as my last meal this sandwich. And then the guy up at the counter who's wearing one of those Lent shirts says, last po' boy, sorry we ran out of crawfish. And it's you in line, and then the guy behind you. You can step aside and give him his dying wish. This just became like very emotionally charged and dramatic. I didn't intend for that to happen, okay? But like, this thing, which is so undeniably good, you can now see under a different light. It would be bad of me to take it when this guy has never had one and has literally been pining away for it for like 87 years, right? Provided that he wasn't pining away when he was one, because I don't know how much he could have known. So like, this thing, which seems to overwhelm you, can be seen as evil under a different respect. So St. Thomas says, this is true with respect to all goods, but one. We could always see it under this aspect or under that. Now, St. Thomas backs this up and says, what is the reason for which this is the case? He says, we are underdetermined with respect to these goods because we are superdetermined with respect to the universal good. Okay, you're like, okay, jumbo, break it out for me. Okay, here we go. So, we are never bound to choose one particular thing because there is a good, the ultimate good, the highest good, which has claim on our hearts. So, a word on the universal good. The intellect is potentially all things. We can know potentially all things. And so, we are ordered to what is universally true. We are never sated with one particular true thing. Like if somebody tells you, like Ben Simmons scored 18 points in the Sixers' last game, you're never going to be like, I know enough. I am satisfied. You're going to want to know how many points he scores tonight, and then the next night, and all 82 nights of the season, and then the further nights of the playoffs, especially in the NBA Finals when he wins. Prediction. Yeah. So, you will want to know potentially all things. Also, the will is the appetite consequent upon our intellect, okay? So we just desire those things that we first know, and thus, our wills are ordered to what is universally good. Our wills are ordered to what is universally good. Whatever we choose in light of the happiness for which we are destined, the perfect good, which has no shadow of change, no shadow of imperfection. So then, how does this condition our engagement with particular goods? Particular goods are then judged in light of the ultimate good as contributing to or detracting from it, but only ever partially. You never look at a particular good and say, like, you complete me. And if you do so, you're lying. Okay? You can mean that in a certain way. Like, before I met you, I was deficient in this, that, or the other way, and you make me a better person. But you're not going to say, like, having you, I need for nothing else, because that's idolatrous. Okay. So, Particular goods are judged in light of the ultimate good as either contributing to or detracting from it, but only partially. And so no particular good compels the will, save the highest good. Which is to say, when you see the vision of God in heaven unto ages of ages, you cannot look away. So, there is a kind of ambivalence in both registers, all right? So there's like, you can do this or you can do that. That's what we mean by ambivalence. There's an ambivalence in both registers, but it's ordered to a kind of increasing attunement to the highest good, and in turn to true and fullest freedom. This is the point, so I'll repeat it. We can choose or we cannot choose. We can see a thing under this light or under that light. But ultimately, the point isn't to revel in the ambivalence. The point is to be increasingly attuned to the highest good and to enjoy true and fullest freedom. So freedom of exercise is poised between self-enslavement and true freedom. You can do it or you cannot do it. But not choosing, or choosing to do or not do things that are bad for you ultimately bind you to choices that are destructive. You either choose to self-enslave or you choose to be truly free. So too, freedom of specification, you know, our ability to see things under this light, under that light, it's poised between counterfeit goods and true freedom. We can become the type of people who see things that are kind of good or deficiently good, or in truth be told, not actually that good, as good. Our eyes can be trained to see things in that way, or they can be trained to see in a way that's truly free. Virtuous habituation, that is to say, growing in virtue, is in choosing the good, we'll realize the full grandeur of freedom. So as we become the type of people who habitually choose the good on the way towards the ultimate good, it becomes easier and prompter and yet more joyful, and we become more free to choose the good for which we are destined, because we are not self-enslaved and we are not like laboring under the deception of counterfeit goods. And we can actually acquire this as a second nature. So, free will or free choice is the ability to choose according to wisdom and to love what is truly good. And it comes to better and better expression as we are habituated in that good. The whole drama of human life then consists in going about this with greater and greater perfection, to go about this with greater and greater facility, to love it and to incline to it, to do so spontaneously and joyfully, without fear of what may come. So we go from being agonized and anguished and paralyzed and riddled with anxiety as to the many options that are on offer to inclining to that good with a kind of dexterity, with a kind of virtuoso alacrity. A couple of examples. Think of a jazz musician, okay? So a jazz musician, we associate them with great freedom, especially when you have a bunch of guys in the same room who can extemporize really well and really beautifully. But what we do not see is the fact that those men have mastered the rudiments. They have put in the time, they have been formed by a culture and a tradition and a kind of musical law, and they are circumscribed within the bounds of that culture. And it's only within the bounds of that culture that they are free to express themselves. Because if one guy says, like, I'm going to do a, you know, atonal piece, and another guy says, I'm going to do a 12-tone scale, and another guy says, like, I'm going to do normal stuff, like, that's not going to be music. It's going to be chaotic. It's going to be awful and ugly. But if they agree upon the standard, if they agree upon the rudiments, if they agree upon the key, if they agree when they're going to modulate and demodulate, when they're going to go from, like, slow swing to bossa nova, then what you can witness is something beautiful, and you can see men with incredible freedom doing precisely what they are made for. Or maybe you're not into jazz. Think of Alvin Kamara, okay? A man who wins, for all of those who have him on his fantasy team, an incredible number of points, okay? He's both running back and wide receiver, sage and muse. Right? So think of Alvin Kamara kind of navigating whether or not he's going to, like, run a flare, whether he's going to kind of squeak out of the backfield and into the second level, or whether he's going to wait for a draw. Like, he's thinking of a lot of things, but he's not going through rules and choosing, like, A or B, B or C, C or D. He feels it in his body. He's able to take the temperature of a defense. He's able to take the temperature of, like, Drew Brees or Teddy Bridgewater, depending on who's injured, or, like, Taysom Hill, if they're going to run a trick play. So he's able to feel these things out because he has mastered the art, the craft of football. And so he is able to be maximally effectual. Like, when you see him in the open field and he does, like, a little shimmy step, you're like, this is what you were born for. It's incredible. Like, there is such a freedom because he is doing what he was made to do. So, what we have here, by contrast to the freedom of indifference, is a kind of freedom for excellence. A freedom for excellence. A perfection of the free will. A kind of virtuosity so that you can choose the good. So that you can abide in the good. So that you can live the good. And not worry about it like other things. It doesn't matter to you that you have fewer options. It doesn't matter to you that you're like not being coerced. Because those are secondary considerations. They're part of freedom, but they're not the whole of it. The whole of it is to be espoused to the good in a way that admits of no infidelity. So, conclusion. Freedom of indifference is but a pale shadow of freedom for excellence. To be indifferent is to be unmoved, unpressured, detached, aloof, uncommitted. But to be excellent is to be bound to the good and spontaneously inclined to what actually represents and is your perfection. So true freedom does not then consist simply in non-coercion and moral ambivalence, but in an actualized power to choose for what is truly good in light of one's nature. Paradoxically, as we saw at the beginning, freedom consists in fixity rather than in non-committal indifference. Return to our first thought then. Heaven is the place of greatest freedom. For only in heaven will one possess the good, whole and entire, without fear of loss or defection, in an internal embrace of undying and ever-abounding joy. Thank you. All right. So we have time for questions. Luke. So the question is, how do we convince others as to this? So, like, the freedom of indifference model has a kind of appeal. The freedom for excellence model obviously takes like 45 minutes to explain, and oftentimes we don't have that much time. But we can, you know, we can distill it in sound bites. And I think that oftentimes you have an opportunity when somebody is about to make a regrettable decision, and they're trying to rationalize and trying to express it as something good. Because I think that people very rarely actually believe themselves when they're about that task. So they're like, all right, let's do something that's like morally dubious. You know, like it's going to involve alcohol and like sordid sexual encounters and it's going to be sweet. And then you're like, wait a second, did you just hear yourself? Like you don't actually believe that. And it doesn't mean that like we're moralizing. We're saying like, that is bad. And if you do that, you are bad. And like, we cannot hang out and you're not invited to Highland Coffee with me. No, that's not what we're saying. Here's a little instance. There was a teacher who taught, whatever, it's not important, the backstory, but a professor who taught Dante's Divine Comedy, and in the Inferno, he got to the seventh circle, the third tier, where you encounter those who are violent against nature, and you encounter a blasphemer there named Capaneus. And the teacher was explaining this, and then one of his students encountered this guy, and he said, this is like the dignity, you know, of the human person. This is like what our excellence consists in, to for all eternity to bellow against God, who has set us on this earth in such a terribly suffering-filled way. And the teacher just said simply, like, what if instead we were to praise him? It was kind of like very simple. And then they had summer break, and then the kid came back, and he comes up to the teacher and says, for the last few weeks I've been receiving the sacraments because I've been haunted by what you said. Because it's like we can have a real confidence, right, that human nature is real and that our hearts are attuned to certain goods. So you have the upper hand because the human heart will always be made for happiness, and happiness can only ever be experienced whole and entire in the Lord. So people may expend incredible amounts of energy, you know, dulling their minds and hardening their hearts, but we always have that natural law written in so that we can recognize what it is that we're made for. And you, it falls upon you to proffer invitations, to do so in a way that's generous and kind, and to do so in a way that's attractive. And you do so principally by the way that you live your life. So I think that, like, I don't know, I've had experiences where I've met people who are truly free. And that for me was just a big occasion of conversion. People who, like, know that they're loved by their parents, by the Lord, by their friends, who don't operate, like, from insecurity, but rather just live their lives with a kind of facility that's radiantly beautiful. And that makes me want to be like them. So that's not entirely helpful, but yeah, there you go. Yes.
So if experiencing God is then the ultimate good that we can possibly hope for, and therefore the ultimate freedom, would it not also stand that all forms of vice or attempts at freedom that were proposed by, for example, that judge who ruled on, was it transgenderism?
That was on abortion. It was Casey Planned Parenthood. So like Aristotle has this understanding of, it's a kind of range whereby one can be formed in his or her character. And one, so he has four categories. So there's the virtuous, the continent, the incontinent, and the vicious. And the virtuous man sees and knows and loves what is good and inclines to it spontaneously. The continent man sees and knows what is good and kind of agonizes over it, but eventually ends up there. The incontinent person knows what is good, is kind of rebuked and chastened by that, but is unable to choose it. So they're weak. He calls it whatever. The words aren't important. And then the vicious man has actually become the type of person who rejoices in what is evil. They have so fashioned their lives, they have so made for themselves a culture, that they are now just kind of spontaneously inclined to what is destructive. You can think of, like, Breaking Bad, okay? Like, it becomes a kind of craft. It becomes a kind of skill to undermine the truly human. And that is a form of self-enslavement. So you become fixed and settled in the way that the virtuous person does, but rather than being fixed and settled in the good, you're fixed and settled in the apparent good, the counterfeit good, the false good. So, yes. Yes. So the question is, why the intellect and will to find our purpose? Why not, like animals, couldn't we be just spontaneously inclined to what we're made for? Okay, so here I think it's helpful to refer to God's purpose in creating. So God does not create us because he needs us. God creates us because he is good. God creates us because he loves, and he affords each rank in the hierarchy of creation a different kind of way of entry into his life. So rocks share in God's beatitude by being rocky. Plants share in God's beatitude by being planty. Animals share in God's beatitude by being animally. And we share in God's beatitude by being what we are. We occupy this place in the hierarchy and order of creation. And part of what we are is free. So he could have made us without freedom, but he chose to make us with freedom as a kind of manifestation of his glory and generosity. You can think about it like he filled every facet with testimony of his divine life. And we occupy this rank. And so we are meant to tell forth this perfection, and part of telling it forth means being free. So there's a kind of grandeur, especially when you consider the fact that we can choose against God and that somehow he incorporates even that in his providence. So yes, he could have made us so that we went instinctually or blindly towards our end, but he didn't. And the reason for which is deep, it is unsearchable. For who has known the mind of the Lord, or who has been his counselor? But what we do know is that it's circumscribed by what we are, right? And we cannot be but what we are and attempt to do so excellently. We have time for one more question. Professor Stoner.
On the unspecified goods, or the specified goods, how do we choose the goods between the merely sensual things and the perfect good of God? You mentioned two of them, music and football, and then suggested, I suppose, there are many other sports and many other forms of music. And then we have many different fields of study, and then we have study as a good and building things as a good, and so on and so forth. What's the principle of choice of all of those things? Because presumably the intellect's at work in making those choices and deciding the practical questions of what way of life to choose in this society which whatever else can be said of it, it does give us extensive room to make choices of those things. We're not bound, as in some ancient and medieval societies, right, to live only the life that our father lived.
Yeah. That's an excellent question, and it's a great one with which to conclude. This will sound unrelated, but it will become so. I don't espouse a soulmate theory. Okay, I don't think that you have a soulmate. I think that there are probably 700 people in the Diocese of Baton Rouge with whom you could be happily married. Okay? And on the one hand, that's terrifying, right? Because there are so many options, and there are so many ways in which to go wrong in pursuing those options. But on the other hand, it's very encouraging that your life is in your hands. So God makes necessary things to happen necessarily, and he makes contingent things to happen contingently. He makes free things to happen freely. So part of our perfection is actually living according to our proper principles. So living as a free creature, which is to say, discerning among goods, and then choosing in our wisdom those which most conduce to our vision of the ultimate good. Now, there are a couple of caveats. Man, this is a great question. Yes. There are a couple of caveats. One, we are limited and circumscribed in our nature, so we do not have the kind of searching knowledge which can entertain all possibilities and run all permutations. We can't do that. Our minds are not made for such an inquiry. And so we begin here with the recognition that we are limited, and that it's precisely in living our lives as limited that we glorify God and pursue our end. So we cannot be, you know, we can't suffer analysis paralysis for fear, if I choose this, I'm not choosing that. That is the nature of every choice conducted in a material universe, that by choosing this, I am not choosing that. By eating dinner at Chimes, I'm choosing not to eat dinner at Raoul's, whatever that's pronounced as. Yeah. Like the place two doors down. Okay, yeah. So, and that's like a great sorrow. But then you recognize that there's a hierarchy and an order, and that you ought to eat at Chimes. Because they built a third story, and it's awesome. So, how then, okay, I'm going to get like increasingly more and more practical. How then does one go about discerning? Well, this is the type of thing, so it's a kind of practical wisdom, that you get better at recognizing the principles and at recognizing the end as you go along. So like Aristotle refers to it as epagoge. It's like something that's governed by phronesis or prudence, okay? So prudence is just practical wisdom. It's right reason with respect to things to be done. And the prudent man grows in a variety of ways. So he has a memory, a kind of storehouse of past choices that he consults. He is docile, so he consults those older and wiser than he, those who have suffered, as a way by which to navigate a course without making foolish choices. He himself is shrewd, you know. He himself is reasonable and has understanding and exercises foresight and is cautious and circumspect. So there are all these facets and dimensions whereby he engages with reality. But effectively, he's like, he has his nostrils to the wind and he's testing his theses against what he smells and adjusting accordingly and then making decisions that best accord with his life. But a lot of it is kind of happenstance, right? We experience it in a kind of chancy or luck-filled way. Why did you become best friends with the person that you are best friends with? We have to admit that it's like kind of an accident. You didn't make an exhaustive Excel spreadsheet and list all of the potential candidates and then host interviews. Because if you did that, you're creepy and you have no friends. Okay? And the person who you think is your best friend is humoring you. All right? So we don't do that, right? We like get into our first grade class and we're like, hey, you've got cool bangs. They're awesome. You know, like, I like 98 Degrees. Do you like NSYNC? And then you're like best friends forever and ever. So a lot of it is chancy, but there's a kind of abandonment or entrustment that our lives are determined in this type of way. They're circumscribed in this type of way. And to what to us seems like chance can actually be provident. So St. Thomas says, you know, it seems chance to the two servants who meet in the marketplace. They're like, how did you come to be here? You know, we both pertain to the same household. But, St. Thomas observes, the same master sent both men to the marketplace. And so their meeting is provident. It is foreseen. All right? And so we go about our lives with the recognition and the confidence that God loves our destiny more than we do. And he has made our lives to unfold in such a way that we are well disposed to come into the very riches or the very excellence for which we are destined. Okay? And we are not laid, or excuse me, we are not kind of like left to our own designs and lights. So St. Thomas talks about how the virtues are perfected by the gifts of the Holy Spirit. So the virtue of prudence, for instance, you're doing your best, you're consulting all of these reasons, you're trying to make a good decision. But St. Thomas says the virtue of prudence is perfected by the gift of the Holy Spirit, which we call counsel, whereby we entertain not only human reasons, but divine reasons. And we are kind of borne on by a divine breath or instinct. He says when we operate by the virtues, it's as if we are pulling at the oars of the ship. And then when we operate by the gifts of the Holy Spirit, it's as if we hoist a sail and are carried aloft by a divine wind. So God is for you. God is decidedly for you. And whenever you look at the crucifix, you know that with an abiding confidence. That's something that you can believe, something that you can trust, because crucified love testifies to it unto ages of ages. And so you do your best. Your life is in your hands. You are free, and life is good. It's not meant to be a series of like false starts and traps or trick questions. The Lord genuinely wants you to delight in your freedom. So if you like enjoy, I don't know, like what do people enjoy? If you like the Miami Dolphins, like the Miami Dolphins, okay? Yes, they're a dumpster fire, but they're your dumpster fire. Okay? And if you like the New Orleans Saints, like cheers, you know, go for it. But you don't have to think like, perhaps I ought to like the Dolphins because they're worse than the Saints. And I need to like exercise mercy on a lesser of two things. And if I'm not, like who will love them if not me? It's just like, don't worry about it, you know. They've got a whole city. They're doing fine. They've always got 72. That's 1972. Perfect season. Cheers. All right. So that's a long and diffuse answer, but I think it merits something. So an excellent question and a great one with which to conclude. So thank you very much.